between what matters and what seems to matter, how should we decide? That simple question is at the heart of skillful living. Between what matters and what seems to matter, how do you decide? One way you cannot decide is by reading the morning newspaper or watching the evening news. A few months ago, when I was in New York City, some interesting events had taken place in the world. Nelson Mandela had been released from prison after some 37 years and had visited the region of Soweto. The Allies had decided that East and West Germany would be allowed to unite. And Donald Trump announced that he was separating from his wife, Ivana. Donald Trump is really a media happening. His name is scratched like graffiti all over the Northeast. Donald Trump simply announced by his impending divorce that while he knew how to make a living, he really didn't know much about life. In the scheme of things, that Donald Trump doesn't matter. And yet, with all of those events, he had gotten the headlines of the New York Times, was on the cover of Time magazine. With wacko journalism like that affecting our minds and spirits, it's difficult to decide between what matters and what only seems to matter. And yet, if you do not make that decision, you end up being a fool. Answering the question, what matters and what only seems to matter, is what separates wise men and wise women from being wise guys. And the only way I know to answer the question is to talk to people who have handled life skillfully. This morning, to be quite honest, I want to plagiarized the thinking of a man by the name of Ivor Jurgensen. He was several years ago, and he's a man who had some keen insights in life. I think you would have liked him. He had a beguiling humility, and more than that, he had a piety, the kind of piety that I enjoy. It wasn't that kind of sticky, sweet piety that's like syrup without pancakes. He was a man who enjoyed life and was a bit of a romantic. And then he had some very keen insights about how life should be lived. In fact, his musings were so impressive that the Spirit of God included the words of Agur in the pages of the Bible. You find them in Proverbs chapter 30. There's one small section of what Agur has to say that I think is worth noting. He says in Proverbs 30, verse 24, four things on earth are small, yet they're extremely wise. Ants are creatures of little strength, yet they store up their food in the summer. Conies are creatures of little power, yet they make their homes in the crags. Locusts have no king, yet they advance together in ranks. And a lizard can be caught with the hand, yet it's found in king's palaces. Usually when we model up. We urge your young people to emulate the lives of saints and martyrs. But Agur, in this case, decides that he will model down. And he chooses for our models ants and conies and locusts and lizards. These creatures have at least two things in common. One is, as he says, they are very small. And the other, by implication, is that they're rather ugly. At least I don't know many people that have pet ants. And there aren't too many people that take a locust out to walk on a leash, can't buy a coney in a pet shop. If you have a lizard in your living room, you're going to stomp him to death. And yet, Agur says that if you would sit at the feet of these creatures, if you'd even find their feet, that they would enable you to answer the question between what matters and what only seems to matter. This is how you decide. He says that the ants are creatures of little strength, that they store up their food in the summer. Putting it another way, the ant knows what time it is in life. Out of the instinct of the past, it uses the present to prepare for the future. There are a lot of folks who are just one-dimensional people. There are people who live in the past. These are the kind of folks who, if they take a trip to the Holy Land, carry a camera, and they're always taking pictures. On the way home in the plane, they say, you know, I had 50 rolls of film. They didn't see Israel. They just saw the inside of the camera. When they get home, however, they show their slides, and that's when they enjoy the trip. These are the folks who go through life looking in a rearview mirror. Then there are folks who live for the present. Their favorite verse is, now is the accepted time. Now is the day to enjoy yourself. And they live as though there were no tomorrow. Then there are a bunch of other folks who live in the future. They like to sing with the musical Annie, tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. Or they join with Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz saying, someplace over the rainbow. After graduation, after I get married, after I get into ministry, after I get out of ministry, after I retire, out there someplace in the future, I'll find my pot of gold. But the ant knows what time it is in life. Out of the instincts formed in the past, it uses the present to prepare for the future. I'm sure if the biblical writers were applying this text, they would apply it to a knowledge of the scriptures. Agur has a good word to say for the Bible in verse 5, where he says that every word of God is flawless. And throughout the book of Proverbs, you are told to know the Bible, to study it, to memorize it, to meditate on it. And the reason that you are to do that is because winter is coming. We live facing a day in the decade and in the millennium ahead, which may be a grim and awful time. Winter is coming. There's going to be cold snows and strong blasts of frigid air. Winter is coming. It's already here, and that you see it in broken homes, in broken lives, in broken dreams, in broken promises. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Like the land of Narnia, it's going to be winter, and there isn't going to be any Christmas. You're going to find, I think, that it's going to be a desolate and awful time in which to live. When I was in college, I had a roommate who had at the foot of his bed the little slogan, as now, so then. It was true then. It's even more true today. What you know about the Bible today is what you're going to bring into that future. As you learn to study the Bible, it is what's going to sustain you in those cold days that lie before us. But anyone today who reads the winter or reads the weather report, whether they are secular or Christian, predicts that there's an awful winter ahead of us. The implication of the text is that the ant, though it doesn't have a lot of strength, uses the strength to store up in summer the food that it needs for the day to come. Ants are industrious. You go to a picnic and you go there to enjoy yourself. Have a cold can of Dr. Pepper, hot dog. But the ant also goes to picnics. But it goes to work. While you're sitting there enjoying the scenery, it's carrying off your sugar one crystal at a time. If you don't watch out, you better protect the potato chips because they'll be back for that. They work at their preparation. I don't think it's stretching the application of this passage to say that if you've got the brains of an ant, you'll do the same thing. That is, in order to understand the scriptures, you've got to work at them. In spite of all of the public relations to the contrary, the Bible is not an easy book to understand. God does not put his jewels out in the surface where you can gather them like dandelions. Most of God's treasure is deep, and you've got to dig for it. God does not give his best stuff to couch potatoes. And so the lesson you need to learn in life is that if you're going to prepare today for the winter that lies ahead, you've got to devote your strength to studying the Word of God. The food you gather now will sustain you in the days to come. So, from the ant, learn what time it is in life. Learn to use the time today to prepare for your tomorrows. The coney, he says, or the conies, are creatures of little power if they make their home in the crags. The ant knows what time it is in life. The coney knows where its security is. The coney is a rock badger, sort of like the prairie dogs we have in Colorado, or it's an exaggerated chipmunk. It is the same color as the rock. Therefore, as it scampers among the rocks, it's very difficult to see. If it's attacked by a mountain lion or there is an eagle about to swoop down on it, it is able to bury itself in the crag of the rock. That mountain lion or that eagle wants to get at that coney, it's got to tear the mountain down. The coney knows where its security lies. The coney itself is a very weak little creature. It doesn't do any good to take bodybuilding lessons in order to build up its strength. And it doesn't do much good to be courageous. The coney gets away from the rock and gets out in the prairie. The most courageous coney in the world becomes dead meat. The coney knows that it's weak, and it knows that it must stay at the rock, because it's in the rock that it has its security. You know as well as I do that the biblical writers would apply that to God. Agur says over in verse 5 that every word of God is flawless, and he is a shield to those who take refuge in him. The psalmist again and again speak of God as a rock, and the apostle Paul puts it in an abstraction when he says, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. So if you've got the wisdom of a coney, you learn where your security is. And your security is in God. Now, in a gathering like this, I think I have to make a distinction. Your security is not in your theology. Theology is like a road sign that points and says the city is off that way. But the road sign is not the city. There are all kinds of people who miss that. I can imagine a whole bunch of conies getting out there in the prairie, and they're going to have a convention. They're going to have a dialogue about the rock. A whole group of people out there who believe that that rock has 5 points. And there are others who insist it's only got 4, and some of them don't have any points at all. It's all rounded. Some will want to argue about the color of the rock, whether it's gray or really black. And others want to talk about the holes, whether you back in or whether you run in, and others want to know if you get away from the rocks, do you lose your sense of security or do you lose your security? And if they're like us, they get their egos all wrapped up in it. And so they separate from one another, start different denominations. Is that analogy absurd? I've been part of a theological society, evangelical theological society. A few years ago, we had a meeting in which we were going to discuss spirituality. We came together. They read papers, all kinds of things about spirituality. All the time we were there, we never sang a hymn. We never stopped to worship. We analyzed the spiritual life, and we knew all about security and all the differences about security. But at least that conference, we never really had much security in God himself. Am I exaggerating? I teach at Denver Seminary. Have on the faculty some very godly people. We do a survey of our graduates, especially of our seniors before they graduate. Ask him a lot of questions. He's asked him, is going to Denver Seminary an intellectually stimulating experience? And the answer across the board is yes. Have we prepared you for ministry? At least as far as they know. What do they know? They're convinced that we have. You ask him a third question. Do you have a better relationship to God today than when you came to the school? Last year, over half of our students said no. I don't know what that does to you. It tears me apart. If that's what academia produces, damn academia. The study of theology keeps you at the road sign and never gets you to God. And forget about it. Your security doesn't lie in a system. Security comes in knowing Him. And let me tell you, that's what people out there are looking for. I deal with pulpit committees. I think one of the proofs that the church is a divine institution is that it's lasted so long with pulpit committees. I mean, it's interesting. But you go to the pulpit committee and, you know, they want you to help, and so you ask them the obvious question. What are you looking for in a pastor? Got seven people in the group and they can't agree. Somebody says, I want is a pastor knows how to relate. I want a pastor who visits. Last pastor didn't visit. You had to die for him to visit you. Somebody else in the group says, I don't know about visiting. I mean, I work all day. I come home. I like to get comfortable, you know? I take off my clothes and just get comfortable. I don't want any preacher coming to my house at night. Somebody else says, we want a pastor who knows the Bible. Boy, I mean, when Pastor Faulkner was here, boy, I mean, he knew the Bible. He could quote the book of Ecclesiastes in Greek. I mean, it was wonderful. And we all said, well, that's all right, but I mean, we need somebody to work with the young people. This church is, you know, looks like it's got a bad case of AIDS. These kids are just leaving on us. I mean, we need somebody who knows how to reach the kids. Somebody else said, I don't know. We had a youth director here, you know, used to go out on hay rides with him. Then he went out on a hay ride with a girl and never came back. I mean, you know, wonder what they want in a pastor. But when you get down to it, and it goes without saying, and it should be said, what most people want in a Christian leader is a leader who knows God. And who knows where his security or her security is. But if you've got the wisdom of a coney, you know two things. You know your weakness, and you know where your strength is. There's some people who know the strength that is in God, but they don't know their own weakness. And so as a result, they become very vulnerable and often very proud. That's what happens to philosophers, to theologians. There are the people who know their weaknesses, like atheists who realize that they are weak but don't know the strength. But the coney is a creature of little power, and he knows where his security lies. You got the brains of a rock badger. You'll be sure that you focus in on that. Locusts, he says, have no king. Yet they advance together in ranks. Locusts know the power of community. One grasshopper amounts to nothing. May jump and frighten you, but it's not going to do much damage. When locusts get together, they can accomplish awesome things. But the word you usually think of is a plague of locusts. Back at the turn of the century, there was a swarm of locusts that went across our Midwest. In about 4 days, they did about $500 million worth of damage in the money of that time. They ripped up the major middle states in the United States. And they did it just in a matter of a few hours. The locust doesn't have any king, doesn't have anybody getting him into bands, but the locust knows the power of community. You and I need to know that. man and some time ago went to an asylum for the criminally insane. He discovers there's only three guards watching about 135 people. He's a little uptight, and he said to one of the guards, aren't you afraid? And those 35 to 3. I said, now, he said, lunatics never unite. Locusts do. Christians should. The Bible knows very little, if anything, about an individual faith. It knows about personal faith, but not individual faith. The word saint is never used in the singular. It is a great teaching of the New Testament that you cannot be a Christian alone. You do not have what God has for you unless you get it from every other Christian you meet. If you do not join with other Christians, you will accomplish absolutely nothing. Seminary is not very good at teaching you that. Do your own work. Take your own tests. Get your own grades. Win your own awards. Guess it's all right here. Doesn't work out there. Marcus knows the power of community. When Jesus sent out his disciples, he sent them out by twos. One person is in a very dangerous position. You need someone else. The Apostle Paul was a man of great authority. After all, Apostle was his first name. But he had around him a band of women and men who supported him in his ministry. He hardly wrote a letter in which he did not refer to them. Phoebe, to Junior, to Epaphroditus, and Onesimus, and Titus, and Timothy, Luke. Come to the end of his life, and Paul is in a dungeon in Rome, and he's now facing death, and he writes that pathetic sentence in the last chapter of 2 Timothy, "Only Luke is with me." Valued Luke, of course, but he wanted more than that. Paul gets the rave notices about turning the first century upside down for God. He didn't do it alone. Paul had a band of people that stood with him, a band of men who were part of his ministry. Locusts advanced together. And then, in the days that lie ahead, we cannot afford the luxury of separation from other Christians. We cannot afford to build walls when we should be building bridges. We will not take this generation from God alone. And God doesn't use lone rangers. You've got to have your tantos. Between what matters and what seems to matter, community is essential to the Christian life and to the Christian mission. Locusts know the power of community. You've got to lick a sense. You'll know it too. And finally, he says, a lizard can be caught with the hand, yet it's found in king's palaces. Of the four lines in this numerical proverb, I think this is the most difficult. Obvious, he says that lizard's small enough to be caught in the hand, and it's found in king's palaces. It's possible that in the context of this section of the book of Proverbs that he is writing to courtiers, young men who are studying for state service. And so he got a lot of advice directed to these people. And one strain of the advice is don't make waves. Don't call attention to yourself. You go to the king's table, don't be a slob. Don't drink alcohol. Watch your friends. If you behave that way, you will end up in the king's palace. It's possible in this context, that's what he's driving at. As I read that and try to think about it, what strikes me is that a lizard in king's palace is incongruous. I mean, what's it doing there? Bonnie and I were celebrating our 25th anniversary. We went down to Acapulco. We stayed in a luxury hotel, and we were up on the 16th story. One day I glanced up near the ceiling. There was there was a lizard. Before I tromped on it, I got to wondering how it got there. You got to walk up the stairs? Did it take the elevator? Did it come in under the door? Did it come from the window? And then even more, how did it get up almost to the ceiling? I'd been there reading a good part of the morning, and I didn't see it. And it just stayed. It didn't move. That lizard in the 16th floor of a luxury hotel was as incongruous as a a lizard in the bedroom of the Queen of England. Out of place. And certainly when you think of the way God works, there's an incongruity in the Bible. A while ago I was fixing our garage door, and there was a screw. I kept trying to loosen that thing, and every time I worked with it, it got tighter. People across the street came out, but he said, oh, he said, that's a reverse screw. It's got left-handed threads. So when you try to tighten it, you loosen it. When you try to loosen it, you tighten it. It took me 50 years to find out how screws work, and then they changed the rules. But in that sense, the Bible's screwy. But it does everything backwards. The way up is the way down. The way down is the way up. If you want to gain your life, you've got to lose it. If you want to be rich, you've got to confess you're bankrupt. Want to be sure, you've got to confess you're empty. Incongruity. It's also incongruous when you stop to think about it for the folks that are going to inhabit heaven. I understand the Bible, God chooses the crowd. And the whole is pretty motley crew. You take this bunch. I mean, they can flash their personality, but the folks out there aren't very impressed. But I think the folks in society are thinking the people that God would use to inhabit heaven, palace with the king, many of us wouldn't make it. God is aware of this sort of choosing lizards to inhabit the king's palace. C.S. Lewis was onto something when he talked about the weight of glory that we bear. I don't think it's very good to think about it yourself, for yourself, but it's good to think about it in terms of other people. These people with whom you live, you think about them. Think about the most nondescript person you know on this campus. The person may be the butt of your jokes or your sly remarks. Not a person who has gifts, the Bible says he has, but he or you have never discovered it. And folks with hard personalities, those kind of folks, think about them. The kind of folks you don't want in your group. If those people were to come back today, as they will be in the future, we would be tempted to fall down and worship them. There are no ordinary Christians. The people with whom you pray and play, with whom you study and work, the people with whom you have lunch, people at the church that are at 11:30 and the rest of the world is at 12, they're not ordinary. You might want to write them off as lizards. God doesn't. One day they will inhabit the king's palace. They, by God's grace, shall bear the weight of glory. And you better think about that when you deal with them. Because there's an incongruity about the way God works. He selects some pretty motley people to inhabit heaven.
There you have it. There's the ant and the carny, locust and the lizard. They're little creatures. But something you need to know, it matters. You need to know what time it is in life and use your time. You need to know where your security is. You need to know the power of community. And you need to recognize the incongruity with which our Creator works. Someday, take a day off. Stop getting an education. Get some wisdom. Find an ant, a coney, locust, or a lizard. You can find their feet. Sit at it. They've got a lot to teach. And believe me, we've got a lot to learn.